This is Women Tech Charge. Subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts. This is Women Tech Charge. I am your host, Anne-Marie Imafadon. And this week, we are joined by a woman who is the triple A. She is an attorney, an author, an advocate. She is Rabia Chowdhury.
I turned off the TV and I went up to my laptop. It was like 1 a.m. at night. And I said, let me see if I can find a journalist who worked on Adnan's story in 1999. And so I found Sarah Koenig, who created the podcast Serial, which became an international phenomenon.
Welcome to the podcast, Rabia.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for giving the time and joining us as well. Again, another international podcast. We're being joined from the suburbs of Washington, D.C., where Rabia has assured me that it is both cold and sunny, which compared to where we are, where I am now in London, it's been raining for about 3 days straight, what feels like 30 days straight. We're going to start this story at the beginning. This is a very good place to start. Rabia, where did you start off your life? Where did the triple A begin from?
Well, the triple A, the first A of that triple A is attorney. And so I kind of began my career journey going to law school, having been a failed medical student, because if you're South Asian and my family's from Pakistan, you're expected to go to medical school. That just wasn't going to happen. So I went to law school, disappointed everybody. But I began my law career doing immigration work and civil rights work. And it was immediately kind of in the aftermath of 9/11. So there was a lot happening in the country at the time and in the community. And while I was in law school, a young man that I had known since he was a child named Adnan Syed, who was 17 at the time, was arrested and charged with murdering a classmate.
A jury convicted Adnan Syed in 2000 of murdering his high school sweetheart.
A witness says Adnan Syed was here at this library at the exact moment the prosecutors say he was out committing murder.
His murder case became a national obsession, and now Adnan Syed is back in the spotlight, this time denied a new trial by Maryland's highest court.
And had you known Adnan before all of this happened, or it was more the relationship he had with your brother?
Yeah, I mean, I only knew Adnan as my little brother's best friend. I mean, to the extent that you can know a younger sibling's best friend, you know, he would be hanging around my parents' house. He was a lot younger than me, 6-7 years younger than me. I lived in another state about an hour away, so I would see him once in a while. My parents, I knew his parents. They lived in the same subdivision as my parents. So yeah, I had known him since he was 12 or 13 years old.
And while the case was going on, was there a particular role that you played kind of as it was happening the first time around?
My role really was to be there to support the family, to support Adnan. I was a student. I had no way to get involved professionally, but I was the closest thing the community had to a lawyer. So what I did try to do was help the family, like when they would go meet the lawyer, when they would try to figure out what's actually happening in the process and try to translate the process for them. And then the following couple of decades, you know, as we were going through appeal after appeal, appeals are so limited. They're so rarely granted. It was so frustrating that finally at some point I said, you know what? I give up. I give up on the courts to give us justice. I want to go to the media. And I really did feel and believe that a journalist would be able to understand this story and find new evidence in the story in a way that lawyers just, they weren't looking at the case in the right way. And so I found Sarah Koenig, who took a year to investigate the case and then created the podcast Serial.
For the last year, I've spent every working day trying to figure out where a high school kid was for an hour after school one day in 1999.
It's time for a break. Send me a message using the hashtag WomenTechCharge and please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to podcasts. How did you find Sarah? How was that someone that came across your path?
I was watching a documentary called West of Memphis on Netflix. It's about a wrongful conviction case of three young men out in Memphis for many, many years ago. And every time I watched a documentary in the case, it changed my perspective. And I turned off the TV and I said, man, the media makes such a difference. You know, the director in that documentary was able to find new evidence that helped to free those young men. And I just turned off the TV and I went up to my laptop. It was like 1 a.m. at night. And I said, let me see if I can find a journalist who worked on Adnan's story in 1999. And I found Sarah Koenig's name. She had written an article about Adnan's attorney. not about Adnan's case, but about Adnan's attorney back in the late 90s, or I think maybe it was the early 2000s, in which she had written about his attorney getting disbarred. So I said, well, I don't know who this is. Let me look her up. Maybe she's still in the Baltimore area. And it turned out she was now a producer for This American Life.
And so what was the gap between that happening and then you meeting up with Sarah and Serial being kicked off?
Oh, for 14 years.
Oh, my goodness. So that's quite a big gap.
It was a big gap because we really all those years trusted in the appeals process. And we just thought, okay, not this appeal. It'll be the next one. It'll be the next one. Until finally I realized it's not going to be any of them.
Podcast then takes off. Can you think back to maybe what you thought would happen versus what then eventually happened with Serial?
I had no idea. I had never heard a podcast before. And I really thought what Sarah Koenig was going to do was investigate this case and make a one episode, This American Life, which was an ongoing show already, just one episode of This American Life. And then she told me well into her investigation that we're going to create a podcast series, 10 or 12 episodes. And I was like, what is that? What is a podcast? and then I thought, well, who's going to listen to that? You know, no one's going to listen to that. I don't even know what that is. I thought, okay, it is what it is. But the truth is this, in many respects, I kind of didn't care what the final product of her investigation looked like in terms of the media. I wanted to know, what did you find? That's all that I cared about. So I was like, do whatever you want. But then it exploded. I mean, the first week they dropped two episodes. And my world completely changed. It was just from all over the world. It was just constant. I mean, those 3 months were some of the most stressful months I've ever endured. The media and the stuff online. It was just crazy, crazy.
And that was a podcast that then grew, and many people will have heard of Serial. Many of them may have listened to it. And it's a new format. It's definitely opened up a new world. I think it's opened up podcasting itself, but also the idea of using media. I think that, like you mentioned, the documentaries is something we've had for so long, but there's something about a podcast that's a little bit more intimate. There's something about a podcast that allows people to kind of process a little bit more and think things through. Is that something you've kind of got as part of feedback or that you experienced, I guess, as you got into the world of podcasts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, Serial did a lot, not just for the world of podcasting, but for the world of true crime. I mean, I think of Serial as like the podcast that launched a thousand podcast ships. I mean, after Serial, so many other journalists and activists have used podcasting for advocacy, and numerous podcasts have now helped solve cases, have helped exonerate people. I mean, after Serial ended, you know, people were not really satisfied because they said, well, what now? What happens to his story next? And I mean, frankly, Serial, they were great journalists, great storytellers, but they weren't investigators, like criminal investigators. So, you know, but there were people who were taking a closer look at the case. They brought so many resources to the case, other lawyers and investigators who wanted to help Adnan. And so I ended up teaming up with two other lawyers and deciding, okay, we've done the three of us were writing a lot about the case, and we wanted to make sure that people were hearing all the other evidence that Serial wasn't able to really explain or even touch. Mm. And we turned that into a podcast called Undisclosed.
Hi, and welcome to the very first episode of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. Today's episode is Adnan's Day.
And we did almost, I think, 25 or 30 episodes on Adnan's case. And so what I learned was people are willing to stay there for the long haul. Our attention spans are not that terrible. So Serial did a lot for this entire space.
And this is you taking that kind of digital platform or that idea of podcasting and being able to use that alongside kind of what you were doing in terms of investigation. Was there anything else or any other use of technology that you saw that was being used in Adnan's case to draw on new evidence? Is there anything else, I mean, aside from the podcasting and technology-wise that excited you or surprised you or helped you?
Social media has completely changed the game on these issues. I mean, we're able to use social media and digital media not just to tell the story, but to gather resources. You know, we've done crowdsourcing, crowdfunding. We've raised $2 million for his defense. We have used that to connect with experts we normally would never connect with. Undisclosed went on to do, we've done like 15 other cases since Adnan's case because other lawyers and innocence projects and people have reached out to us, and we have over the years used this technology that connects us to make it easy for witnesses to come forward, to contact us, to give us new evidence, and to brainstorm when we can't figure something out. The connectivity is just has changed how we're approaching all these cases.
I guess you're normally on the lawyer side, or you're trained to be on the lawyer side. In terms of police forces, is there anything exciting that you've seen, or any surprises that you've had in bringing these technologies to police forces?
Well, you know, the truth is, in many of these cases, because we're talking about wrongful convictions, and when you have wrongful convictions, you often have great lapses in police work that led to those wrongful convictions. Mm. So we rarely work directly with the police, but you know, some of the stuff that has happened is that there's been great leaps in technology, like DNA technology, genetic genealogy, that helps investigators and the police, you know, who might find DNA, but it doesn't match anybody. And so what do you do? And now there's these genetic databases that you can plug that into and see, okay, is there somebody out there who might be related to whoever left this DNA behind at a crime scene? So the technology on the forensic end has changed dramatically. And that's another thing, that as we're looking at cases that are 15, 20, sometimes 30 years old, we can do things with that evidence now that we couldn't do 30 years ago, 20 years ago.
Many things have moved on in 30 years. I guess in general in life, but I think with technology, it moves so quickly that you're right, being able to take that old evidence and apply new techniques to it, I'm sure must have changed so many lives just from these kind of wrongful convictions.
The police are, you know, open to using some of the newer technology, and also, by the way, debunking some of the old theories. I mean, there was a whole field of junk forensic science that we know now none of it makes sense. I mean, things like bite mark tech, you know, bite mark forensics was a thing. And so over time, we know what works and what
doesn't. For how long was that something? Bite mark technology, forensics?
Oh, I mean, it's still in some places, it still exists. I mean, blood spatter experts, these are things. Well, it's not really a thing. The way that hair analysis was done, ballistic analysis has changed dramatically. I mean, for decades, I mean, actually this entire century, the past century, the police have said, hey, if we find some bullets, we know how to match it to a gun.
Yeah.
It's highly, highly unreliable technology. And so we know that now. And so you can use it. You can challenge that kind of evidence in court.
You're listening to Women Tech Charge. Subscribe and rate on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So there's been lots. I know you're an attorney, you're an author, you're an advocate, you're a woman in tech. I think we're going to call you someone that's been able to use technology to do all sorts of things and change things. I wanted to talk to a little bit about your work with integrating communities. To what extent has technology informed the work that you've been doing in that space?
9/11. Happened right after I got out of law school. I literally just as I was graduating from law school, and that put me in a position that a lot of young American Muslims found themselves, which is like suddenly having to deal with these community issues where on one hand you have to protect the rights of your community, but on the other hand you also have to take some of these threats seriously, and balancing that very carefully while making sure that people's civil rights are protected, at the same time national security is ensured. So, you know, I began a firm called the Safe Nation Collaborative under the Obama administration. And what we did through that was to train community integration and not even integration so much, but I would say collaboration, working with certain state agencies, not federal agencies, but state agencies, basically knowing who is in your community, who is the law enforcement agencies in your community, who do you call if there's something going on? And also, on the other hand, equipping local law enforcement with proper education about our communities, instead of like kind of the hateful rhetoric that they and the scary stuff that they found online. I mean, believe me, I remember one time meeting a police intelligence officer who told me that anytime she needed to learn anything about Islam or Muslims, she just Googled it.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, that's why we're in so much trouble here. So, you know, we use technology in that front because we incorporated social media into it. A lot of it was done online, and you know, it was just having those tools just makes it just so much easier. I mean, there are times when I was able to demonstrate, for example, in front of an audience of Muslim parents, how easy it was for their children to pick up a cell phone and basically be chatting with somebody who's like an ISIS member across the world in less than 10 minutes.
I think this was something that we definitely, so I'm from East London, and the ISIS, the three kind of girls that went as the ISIS brides, however many years ago it was, I think this is definitely something that's shaken the community, where I think from the outside, it looks almost as if it's something that's a problem within the community, whereas lots of local mums and dads were saying, you know, they didn't realise that this was what was capable. This is not really how they've raised their children. It's not the values that they've given them. But it'd been these kind of outside influences using digital for bad, as much as we can use digital for good, to implant ideas and yeah, all kinds of things going on.
My perspective always has been that it's no different than the kind of grooming that these groups do, whether it's a white nationalist group, whether it is a Islamic jihadist group, whether it's any kind of, you know, ideologically problematic group, is no different than like the kind of grooming that sexual predators do online. So when these young people get caught up in this stuff, it's not about values. It's about their vulnerability to predators. And so when you frame it like that, you stop demonizing communities and parents who have no idea, and you start helping to equip them to protect their children. When I talked to parents about this issue, when I did talked about, you know, when we ran this program, I said, this is about you protecting your children. I don't care about the police. I'm here to talk about national security. In the same way you'd want to protect your 15-year-old daughter from a sexual predator online, you want to protect her from somebody who's going to convince her to travel to Syria online.
So it's fascinating to know that you're a lawyer that's been able to take this all in. Is that something that when you look to the next generation of lawyers and the kind of legal industry, is that something that you're seeing more and more people being able to take advantage of digital skills or digital platforms? Or do you find that actually quite big parts of the industry are still trying to hold back from this and trying to do things the old way?
You know, lawyers don't like change. we love the old ways. It is hard to get lawyers to understand the importance of these tools and to learn how to use them. And part of the problem is that there hasn't been, I mean, like, you know, lawyers are always governed by all these different ethical guidelines in every single jurisdiction. There haven't really been any developed around social media tools and digital media tools. So that has to happen. I think that's what really scares lawyers, because they don't know what's okay and what's not okay. How do you protect your clients? How do you not tell too much information? But it's interesting, just this past year, there's an organization in New York called the Brooklyn Defenders, and they are defense attorneys and also public defenders who for the first time ever organized a 3-day conference teaching lawyers, criminal defense attorneys, how to use social media and digital media tools for their for their clients and for their work. I mean, it's amazing that it's 2019 and it's the first time that somebody's thought this is a good idea to do. I've been arguing for years now that law schools have to teach lawyers better communication skills, not just the substance, but the form as well.
Right.
So I think this is a new frontier in all of this. We're gonna figure it out as we go along. But there's a lot of resistance to it. But we have to move with the times.
The other discussion I've been a part of quite a lot in the UK is the laws and that we have surrounding a lot of the use of these platforms. So it's something we've spoken about a little bit on the podcast this season. But kind of when we talk about online abuse, when we talk about a lot of these digital platforms and the things that are happening and being allowed to happen using them that wouldn't necessarily work or be legal kind of face to face or in any of the platforms that we've already had. I always find it quite interesting that you can't just take, you know, what we have in the real world and apply it to digital platforms. It almost has to be rewritten to say it's not okay to use these words in real life when we already have that as a law, but we now need to rewrite that in and say if you tweet them it's not okay, or if you, you know, communicate that using that digital platform, then that's going to be taken as evidence against you.
Oh, right. Absolutely. I mean, like it's, you know, and it's further complicated in the United States because we have the First Amendment, which, you know, free speech, and the free speech that the First Amendment is meant to protect is almost always ugly, offensive speech. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not a crime to be offensive and ugly. But then what do you do when you have tweets that are incendiary, that, you know, incite violence or incite some other kind of actual criminal activity that's happened? And how do you deal with that? And so the courts are having to navigate all these kind of difficult situations. I mean, there was a case not long ago where a young woman, over text message, not even in person, encouraged her boyfriend to commit suicide. Yeah, and he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so can you use that as, is that evidence? And with President Trump, are his tweets presidential communications, official presidential communications? You know, all of these things the courts are now going to have to grapple with. And one of the scarier parts of that is that a lot of these courts are full of people who are not even familiar with the tools. They don't use them. They're older folks who just really have never been on social media. They have to understand how all of it works. You know, but I think, you know, over generations that'll change too, you know, in about 15, 20 years, we might have to revisit some of the decisions that are being made today.
I'm hoping so. I think we're seeing this a little bit with people like AOC and her questioning. And I know there's a new round of senators and people who understand a little bit more and are poking those questions. I think from our side, maybe based in the UK, I've always had this prevailing sense that we need more people in control who kind of understand maybe some of this or aren't afraid to pick up the skills. I think, you know, if we look just at your trajectory, it's now become quite digital, even though you're still law. So how do we allow people to know that it's a skill that they can take on to be literate in this world, to be powerful in this world, to have influence in this world, but also to protect and to be used as a change, or to be used as a force for good in this world, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a lawyer or whatever you might be. So you've gone a little bit full circle, I guess. You were kind of spurred on by the Netflix documentary that you were watching. You're now working on projects with HBO and with Netflix. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. So, you know, I wrote a book about the case in which, you know, Adnan contributed to that book, the subject of all of this. It became a New York Times bestseller. It was optioned for a documentary series, which I helped executive produce for HBO earlier this year, and it also aired in the UK. And so, you know, the interesting thing about that documentary series was that it was directed by Amy Berg, and Amy Berg was the director of the Netflix series I had seen the night that I reached out to Sarah Koenig all those years ago.
There we go.
It's been amazing. And so that series came out this year. And, you know, again, Amy Berg, like she did in the previous series or documentary I'd seen, did find more evidence for the case. Mm. It was 3 years in the making. And then with Netflix, you know, a lot of traditional media companies, and Netflix is not exactly traditional, but it's been around long enough now but they're realizing the power of podcasting. So they are now launching a new podcast series to help support their original productions. And so this year they asked me to write a script for one of the episodes of this new podcast series.
Okay, very cool.
And the episode will air on December 4th. Mm-hmm. And I believe if you go to Netflix.com or you just go to your Netflix or go to your podcast app and search for Netflix, the Netflix podcast series will pop up. And it will be called Because I Watched. That's the name of the podcast.
Okay.
And my episode, the one that I have scripted, is about the series called Delhi Crime.
We've not got much longer in the episode. I wanted to just throw something to you as a lawyer who's now found herself increasingly technical and digital, and that's about the future. What do you think the future holds for the law profession? I speak all the time. I get to speak to all kinds of people, and there's a gig I've done twice actually in the last 2 months to a group of lawyers, and I always enjoy, you know, talking about artificial intelligence, machine learning, 3D printing, all these kind of tech trends, and helping relate it to, you know, what the legal profession is looking at and grappling with. One example that I almost always try and show is the algorithm Do Not Pay, that helps anyone who's got a parking ticket. It's kind of a robot lawyer that you give it the details of your case, and it does the appeal for you. You kind of print and then you send it off, and there's no interaction with the lawyer as part of the process. You know, there's lots of surveys that are done about robots taking our jobs and how kind of the middle layer of the legal system is one of those places that's most at risk. What do you think the change is going to be? What's the gap at the moment? And how much do you think, you know, this fourth industrial revolution, as we tend to call it, how do you think that's going to change the legal profession? How can you see it changing the legal profession already?
I think the biggest change that's going to happen is suddenly we are going to see more power to the people. And one of those reasons is because the average person can now document things they're seeing, put it online, and then demand answers from the system, which they couldn't do before. People, the average person wants to know more about how the system works. One of the most remarkable things that's happened in the last 5 years since we've been doing Undisclosed is that we get hundreds of messages from listeners who are like, I never understood what was going on. I did not understand the system because the law is closed. Lawyers like to use language that nobody understands. We want to use procedures that nobody understands. We want to stay up in our ivory towers while mere mortals have to clamor for our assistance. But I think digital media and technology is going to give power back to citizens in terms of their legal rights, understanding the system, getting support. And I think that's a good trend. I think our systems need accountability, and this is one way it's going to happen.
Fantastic. Power to the people. What a good place to end. So where can people find you if they would like to get involved, if they'd like to feel that power or get clued up on the tools that are available to them? What would you suggest?
I'm always on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Rabia Squared, so you can always find me there personally. Our podcast, I have two podcasts. One's the 45th, which is a weekly political podcast about the 45th administration, the Trump administration. The other one is Undisclosed, which is a long-form, deeply investigative legal podcast about wrongful convictions in which we work directly with defendants and their families and their lawyers. And there's always a mystery, a whodunit at the heart of it. So, you can search for both of those online on any of your podcast apps and follow us there. And as always, support all the local organizations that are doing this work anyways.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining me this evening, this afternoon, this morning, wherever you are in the world. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
You can subscribe to Women Tech Charge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.